You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
How blessed are we to have such beautiful gifts amongst us, eh? We wish to acknowledge that we are in the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit Nation lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. Each week, in order to remain aware of our treaty obligations and the relationship we have with our First Nations sisters and brothers, we read one of the 94 recommendations sent to all levels of government by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We expect to complete these readings in June of 2007. And today is recommendation number 20. In order to address the jurisdictional disputes concerning Aboriginal peoples who do not reside on reserves, we call upon the federal government to recognize, respect, and address the distinct health needs of the Métis, Inuit, and off-reserve Aboriginal peoples.
Grounded, Guided, Growing, A Time for Centering, from Scott Kearns.
We use this time musically and in silence to just remind ourselves of what we center around, what we can center around, what the world can center around. And we use the word grounded simply to say what do we know that we can count on? What do we know that's true? What do we know that's beyond contesting? And we've sort of worked that through around here to figure that that's just life. There it is, there we are. And the truth of it is it has an enormous impact on us. And the other big truth is that we have an impact on it. And so that truth is what we sit with, to keep our eyes wide open to the realities of life. And when Greta and I were in Atlanta, I think we mentioned that we visited the Center for Human and Global Rights in Atlanta, Georgia. And walking through, you saw all of life. You saw it in its raw, torturous wickedness, and you saw it in its bravery and its courage and its beauty and its triumph as they depicted the struggle for human rights in the city, in the state, in the country, and in the world. And so when we look at that raw reality out there, we look for a guide in a simple principle and a very hard thing to do, which is to love compassionately and justly all people. And since that's so hard to do, we share wisdom together to do that with. So the song we will center ourselves with is very familiar, and it was used in the middle of some of the very difficult struggle for respect for all. So I'm going to work it into the little interlude here, and as soon as you recognize it, you're welcome to hum along before we put the words up to sing that. So take it in that so many have used this song to ground themselves in life, guide themselves with love, and grow in wisdom together.
Each week, we gather together in this space, and we come here different than we have ever been before. Some of you are here for the very first time, so you really have never been here like this before. But each of us, you know, whether we were here last Sunday or during the week at some point in time, things change. Life changes. We experience stuff. We come into contact with information and with people that change our lives, change our perspective, and challenge our worldviews. And we try to be open to those challenges, to those changes, open in ways that commit us to a new way of living, a new way of being ourselves expanded and altered as ourselves have come to be in the world. And part of that process is coming here each week and sharing not only the things that have happened around the world and the things that have happened in our community, but the things that have happened to us and the concerns and the joys, the delights and the sorrows, and how they weave themselves into our hearts and we weave them into this community. And we do that because it's an important part of building resilience in the community and in ourselves, so that when we do come into confrontation with things we've never experienced before or people who, you know, might not be making our day better, we can respond with strength and with courage and with compassion, and we can create something beautiful. It's our opportunity to create something beautiful out of whatever circumstances we find ourselves in. So there are three parts to this time that we spend sharing who we are and what it is that is important to us. The first is an opportunity for us to just name places and groups in the world that are in need in one way or another. The next is an opportunity to share more deeply of our own experiences. And then the third is to identify those groups and those individuals who are actually, you know, cracking the code to change, making things alter in big ways or even in little ways that create a ripple effect and will bring about some of those things that we long for and that we sang about in the song. Many of us despair that, you know, maybe that day will never come. And the truth is that if we don't do anything about making it so, it will never come. And so we come together as a community to encourage ourselves, to wrap our hearts around one another so that we can do that work and do it well. May we stumble forward if we cannot walk with courage in ways that can make change in the world. May we at least stumble forward haltingly and hesitatingly, but forward nonetheless, so that our actions and our words, our commitments might be put to the work of easing suffering in this world, of growing compassion, of challenging systems of oppression. May we, having heard all of this hurt and all of this need in this space, may it be carved upon our heart. And may our heart, as it beats, may it stretch those places so that we might find ways to be present as agents of change in a world so in need of it. In this, our time of need, may love abound. May we be inspired by the activities of those who see the world differently, who see it come about in a more positive way because they see the realities of poverty, of grief, of illness, of bereavement, of the circumstances of geographic birth. And they do something about what those realities knit into people's lives. And they do it in a way to make those lives more beautiful and stronger and more healthy. And may we find ways to commit ourselves to be present in that work. In this abundant blessing, we share the joy.
Our reading this morning is a gift of words from Geraldine Brooks, and it's an excerpt from her book called Caleb's Crossing. He had scooped up another handful of sand and stared at each grain as it fell through his fingers. You are like these, each a trifling speck, 100, maybe hundreds, what matter? Cast them into the air. You cannot even find them when they land. But there are more grains than you can count. There is no end to them. You will pour across this land and we will be smothered. Your stone walls and dead trees, hooves of your beasts trampling the clam beds. My uncle sees these things here and now. And in his trance, he sees worse is coming. Your walls will rise everywhere until they shut us out. You will turn this land upside down with your plows until all the hunting grounds are gone. This and more my uncle sees. offer it as wisdom for the journey.
Focused Moments from Greta Vosper.
The focused moment this morning is going to be spontaneous rather than having been written, so some of you may have been looking for it. I'm sorry that we didn't have one for you. But it's built around the theme for the morning, but also picks up off the reading, because the reading is from Geraldine Brooks' book, Caleb's Crossing, which is Geraldine Brooks is a fantastic author who takes one little tiny piece of history and weaves an entire fictional story around it. And so the piece of history is the first Aboriginal graduate from Harvard University, around which she writes this incredible tale about the loss of one's spiritual connection with one's people and the cost of that. It's an incredibly beautiful book. And in it, Caleb is sharing with his friend, the protagonist of the novel, that his uncle sees things, and he's sharing this prophetic vision that his uncle has had. But I would argue that prophets only see what will be because they see what is so clearly. And so in this focused moment, which is really going to be the collection of a beginning of a number of letters, I'm going to leave some space for you to imagine what happens in that letter after each one. And then at the end, I'll just say dear and leave a space for you to imagine a letter that you might share with someone about what it is you really see. Dear Aaron, I cannot believe that it's been... Dear James, last week, I went back to where... Hi, Courtney. I know it's been a little while, but I needed to tell you. Dear Dad, I'm sorry about the last time. Clara, I know I seemed to be... Dear Jacob, I know it was just yesterday, but I wanted to tell you... Mackenzie, we've been together for... Dear... Thank you. Today I'm talking about letters as tools for us to speak what's really going on in our lives and in the relationships that we have with one another. How we sometimes can use it to keep up with people, to just write down days, to share information. I had a beautiful quote written out that I wanted to share with you, and I printed out the wrong document, but it was a gentleman who wrote every day. He wrote to a woman, wrote out his day, wrote out everything he did, wrote his life out. He had a box, a mahogany box that he would put the letters in at the end of the day, and it was filled with all these letters, and you'd wonder why he hadn't sent them to the woman, but it was because he hadn't yet met her. And he wanted her to have his life in the same way that she would have had it if he was writing her letters had he known her. And when he did meet her, that woman, he'd give her the box, and she'd open it up, and she might pick one up and read through it carefully and wonder at everything. Or she might be the kind of woman that opened the box and laughed and dumped it upside down, his life surrounding them like snowflakes, and he would love her forever. I love that so many people have history written out in the stories of their lives. People who have written letters to one another for ages and ages and ages. I can remember my mother every Sunday afternoon sitting down at the old harvest table in our kitchen, which was so horribly warped it had to have glass on top of it so that she could write. And she would write every week to her mom, who didn't live all that far away. She lived in Kempville, which was, you know, an hour and a half from Kingston. But she wanted to tell her what was going on with her children, with her world, with her life. Even when she was back at work after we were further on in high school, she always managed to sit down and write a letter. And I bet you that if my grandmother had kept all those letters and we were able to see them now, the things that we would read about what our lives had been like that we couldn't possibly remember, none of us could remember, and certainly we wouldn't have remembered them from the same perspective that my mother had experienced them and recorded them, And I think, oh, how I wish I had my grandmother's bundle of letters. When I was interviewed recently by Toronto Life, they asked me what I was like as a teenager, and I just said, you know, I drove, and they misinterpreted that as I drove drunk. So I had to straighten them out about that one. But really what I should have said was, I dated bad boys. I mean, that would have made so much sense. One of the guys I dated rode a motorbike, and I can remember my father saying to him after he watched him drive down a flight of stairs with me on the back of the motorbike, "You almost killed my daughter there." And my boyfriend said, "Well, almost killed isn't quite dead, is it?" Yeah. There was another one that wore this sort of cream-colored snakeskin jacket. And my mother really loved him. He painted me life-size posters of Lou Reed and David Bowie. And he's now a painter. Like, he paints. And I'll bet you anything my mother threw them out the first day I left for university. But I don't have them now, and I wish I did. But we dated during a summer when I worked as a mother's helper in Quebec, down in the eastern townships, taking care of three little children. And he wrote me letters on, you remember that crisp blue air post paper? Very thin. And he wrote these letters in gold ink. One every day. I kept them for years. I think I was in the middle of my second marriage when my mother said, "Honey, we got to do something about these letters." And I got rid of them. Can't believe I did that. I mean, they didn't take up that much space. I really could have kept them for a while. But it was when I was at university, having, you know, been through that awkward dating bad boys phase at home, where my relationship with my mother had become somewhat strained. Some of you may be familiar with that kind of thing. And I actually went to university a year early just to get out of the city. So I went down to the Maritimes, where you didn't have to do grade 13, and started university at Mount Allison University. And my mother sat down every Sunday afternoon and wrote me a letter. I can remember that postage stamps were 8 cents then, because I went through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, writing to my friends and to my mother. But in those years there at school, we repaired our relationship, my mom and I. She made sense on paper. In a way she'd never made sense before. And she guided me page by page through that tumultuous time in my life and onto a stability that I've never left. And how I wish I had those letters now. We use letters to stay in touch, and we don't do it that much anymore. John Shelby Spong, one of my greatest mentors and closest friends and the guy I call Dad now, he writes like 60 letters a day, I think. I have no idea how he does it, and I've tried to emulate it. He told me it would be a really good thing, Greta, if you could just handwrite a bunch of letters every now and then. And I've tried to do that, and I can't keep up with it. It's so much easier and faster to just fire off an email, but who doesn't feel great when they get a letter in their mailbox, like a real letter with a stamp on it and everything, not just some junk mail from, you know, the furniture store that's going out of business, but something that someone has thought to put down on paper and send to you. And often their thank yous, or as Margaret said, their condolences, they're opportunities for us to engage in a different way. A way that we're very casual about now. It's a form that has been used down through time, and Annie picked a picture that had a seal on it. Letters were the ways that great ideas, great laws, great choices were made by the leaders of the world as we evolved as humanity, as they sent tracts that allowed somebody into their kingdom or denied someone the right to live. Those pieces of paper created momentous moments in history. That was sort of redundant. But you know what I mean. They were big things that happened, and they were written out longhand and shared with people. There's something that happens, I think, in your head when you write longhand that's very different from what happens when you type. Julia Cameron talks about doing pages every morning as a way to get all that stuff out of your head so you can actually reach the creative element within you. But what if you were to pick somebody that you had to have a real deep conversation with, and you were to write pages and pages and pages of just anything that came to mind when you were thinking about them until you got to that piece that needed to be shared, until you got to that truth that you could see that would be prophetic about your future together, that you needed to actually converse about, and you got everything out of the way, and there it was on paper. How many people have done that and then never mailed the letter? Because that truth was a little too powerful to share that way, but you knew it would never be shared in person. We do that all the time. It's a tool that's been used down through the course of history, too, to speak truth to power. As we write our letters to government officials, to the heads of corporations, to people who we know have power in their hands and can wield it in a way that we would like to influence somehow. And so we write these letters demanding that they pay attention to us. We write letters to grocery stores telling them to stop selling plastic bottled water. And we write letters to the government saying, please, you know, like, rethink that whole Saudi Arabia arms deal, right? Like, we write letters asking for someone to pay attention because we think we have something to say. In November 1956, Martin Luther King Jr. picked up a pen and started writing a letter. He used as his model letters that were written, that were collected in the New Testament, called epistles, and some of them started out saying, you know, speaking to a particular church. And Martin Luther King Jr. wanted to talk to the Christians in America at that point in time because he knew what the future was looking like, and it was not pretty. And he knew that because he could look around him and see what the present day was. What was going on in his country? Stuff that wouldn't be addressed for ages yet. And still, lo, these 60 years later, is still creating tumultuous moments in the history of that country, and indeed around the world. So he picked up a pen, and emulating those predecessors who had spoken truth to communities spread throughout the region, he spoke truth to those in his country that he felt needed to hear it. And so on this, you know, day very close to Martin Luther King Jr. Day, I thought I would write a letter using his as a model. Picking up Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter, and it's one of my favorite pieces of his writing. It's in his book, Strength to Love. Picking it up and rephrasing it for us for now. Not to send a letter to the world that says, this is what you're doing wrong, but to send a letter to us saying, remember we saw this and we thought that maybe there was something we could do about it? Remember we were going to stand strong against something? Or remember we had that conversation and look, stuff is still like this. So I ask you to oblige me. Let me share with you my Martin Luther King Jr. letter. He was writing Paul's letter to the American Christians, and I'm writing Socrates' letter to seekers after truth. I would like to share with you an imaginary letter from the pen of Socrates. The postmark reveals that it comes from the city of Athens. After opening the letter, I discovered that it was written in Greek rather than English. At the top of the first page was this request: please read to your congregation as soon as possible and then pass on to the other churches. For several weeks, I have worked assiduously with the translation. It's been a long time since I took Greek. At times, it has been difficult, but now I think I have deciphered its true meaning. May I hasten to say that if in presenting the letter, the content sounds strangely Vosper-ish instead of Socratic, attributed to my lack of complete objectivity rather than Socrates' lack of clarity. It is a stretch of the imagination, of course, to consider that Socrates should be writing a letter to you and me nearly 2,500 years after his last words were uttered at his death. Indeed, stranger still, since we have no original documents ever written by him, but know of his work only through the pens of those who knew him and his words. How this is possible is something of an enigma wrapped in a mystery. The important thing, however, is that I can imagine Socrates writing a letter to us in 2016 CE, and here is the letter as it stands before me. I, a disciple of wisdom, to you who live in the 21st century, grace be unto you and peace. For many years I have longed to be able to come to see you. I have heard so much of you and what you are doing. I have heard of the fascinating and astounding advances that you have made in the scientific realm. I have heard of your dashing subways and flashing airplanes. Through your scientific genius, you've been able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. You have been able to carve highways through the stratosphere and beyond, pressing your presence far beyond the imagined distances of my time. So in your world, you have made it possible to eat breakfast in New York City and dinner in Paris, and to send sisters and brothers to look down upon you from your moon and beyond. I have also heard of your skyscraping buildings with their prodigious towers steeping heavenward. I've heard of your great medical advances, which have resulted in the curing of many dread plagues and diseases, and thereby prolonged your lives and made for greater security and physical well-being. All of that is marvelous. You can do so many things in your day that I could not do in the Greco-Roman world of my day. In your age, you can travel distances in one day that took me 3 months to travel, and that is wonderful. You have made tremendous strides in the area of scientific and technological development. But my friends, as I look at you from afar, I wonder whether your moral and spiritual progress has been commensurate with your scientific progress. It seems to me that your moral progress lags behind your scientific progress. The poet Thoreau used to talk about improved means to an unimproved end. How often this is true. You have allowed the material means by which you live to outdistance the spiritual ends for which you live. You've allowed your mentality to outrun your morality. You have allowed your civilization to outdistance your culture. Through your scientific genius, you have made a world of the neighborhood, but through your moral and spiritual genius, you have failed to make of it a brotherhood. So, my friends, I would urge you to keep your moral advances abreast with your scientific advances. I am impelled to write you concerning the responsibilities laid upon you to live as people ever seeking truth in the midst of a deceitful world. This is what I had to do. This is what everyone has to do. But I understand that there are many among you who give their ultimate allegiance to systems and customs of privilege, sectarianism, and self-centered absorption. They are afraid to be different. Their great concern is to be accepted socially. They live by some such principle as, everybody's doing it, so it must be all right. For so many of you, morality is merely group consensus. In your modern sociological lingo, the mores are accepted as the right ways. You have unconsciously come to believe that right is discovered by taking a sort of Gallup poll of the majority opinion. How many are giving their ultimate allegiance to this way? But you who seek truth, I must say to you, as was said to forebears of one of your great religious traditions years ago, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. Or as was also said, you are a colony of heaven. I've always understood heaven as that eternal realm of pure ideas commingled with beauty and the best of human impulses. So this means that although you live in the colony of your time, your ultimate allegiance is to the empire of eternity. You have a dual citizenry. You live both in time and eternity, both in the realm of ever-evolving ideas of truth, goodness, and beauty, and earth. Therefore, your ultimate allegiance is not to the government, not to the state, not to nation, not to any humanly constructed system or institution. The seeker after these ephemeral ideals owes his ultimate allegiance to truth, goodness, and beauty. And if any earthly institution conflicts with these, it's your duty to take a stand against it. You must never allow the transitory, evanescent demands of our systems and institutions to take precedence over the eternal demands of goodness, beauty, and truth. I understand that you have an economic system that has functioned for many generations, and that is known as capitalism. Through this economic system, you've been able to do wonders. You have become one of the richest nations in the world, and you have built up one of the greatest systems of production that history has ever known. All of this is marvelous. But my friends, there is a danger that you are blind to the misuses of capitalism. I agree with the mind that noted money can be the root of all evil. It can cause one to live a life of gross materialism. I'm afraid that many among you are more concerned about making a living than making a life. You are prone to judge the success of your profession by the index of your salary or the size of the wheelbase on your automobile rather than the quality of your service to humanity. The misuse of capitalism can also lead to tragic exploitation. This has so often happened in your world, especially as the global economy has developed and trade agreements impinge on individual rights. They tell me that 1% of the world's population controls 48% of the wealth. Most of the information to which you pay attention about that 1% soothes you because you like to think of yourselves as part of the 99%, which in the United States of America, you probably, very probably would be. You'd have to make over $400,000 US dollars a year to get into the American 1% club. But you are citizens of the world, and the worldwide club has a much lower membership fee. You need to only make about $40,000 each year. I've adjusted that for the lagging loony. To be in the 99th percentile, making more money than 99% of the people on this planet. My, oh my. How often you have taken necessities from the masses to give luxuries to the classes. If you are to be committed to that eternal pursuit of goodness, beauty, and truth, you must both acknowledge and work to solve this problem. You cannot solve the problem by embracing a postmodern indifference for systems that draw their nourishment from an ethical relativism beyond the moral absolutes once defined by religion, a belief that there is no more bad than that, will dull, diminish, and destroy some of the most exquisite elements of human creativity and potential. You can work within the framework of democracy to bring about a better distribution of wealth. You can use your powerful economic resources to wipe poverty from the face of the earth. No single people can be content to live in superfluous, inordinate wealth while others live in abject, deadening poverty. It is your responsibility to expand upon that idea. If human dignity is to be preserved, all humans must have the basic necessities of life, even and especially if our luxuries must be compromised in order to ensure that they do. So I call upon you to bridge the gulf between abject poverty and superfluous wealth. You have the wisdom and the ability to devise ways to bring this about the world over. I would that I could be with you in person so that I could say to you face to face what I am forced to say to you in writing. Oh, how I long to share your fellowship. So let me rush on to say something about religion. Truth seekers, I must remind you, as I have said to so many others, that religion is fundamentally a moral pursuit. So when religions clash, it is the study of morality that can bring them together. But I am disturbed about the ongoing refusal to do that. I cannot be blamed for believing 2,500 years ago that gods existed. But I argued that they contradicted each other, as the stories of their actions certainly exposed. My life became devoted to finding within each human being the moral impetus identified by their choices, honed by their own exploration of those choices, and ultimately reflecting on the moral nature of humanity itself. How many thousands of religions are there now, each proclaiming a moral authority they argue is true? How can it be possible that so many versions of what is right can be right? The tragedy brought about by this is not in the many ways in which humans seek to explore goodness, beauty, and truth, ephemeral elements, the engagement of which I call spiritual, but that most of them are warring against each other with a claim to absolute truth. This narrow sectarianism is destroying the unity of the human family. You must come to see that truth is neither Christian Baptist nor Theravada Buddhist. It's neither Baha'i nor Muslim. It cannot be pursued if the human mind is locked up in a fundamentalist doctrinal perspective of any kind. Truth is bigger than all of our attempts to capture it within a religious tradition. If you are to be true witnesses for truth, you must come to see the ways in which it is compromised by traditions you too often hold dear. But I must not stop with a criticism of religion. I am disturbed too about this new thing, corporatism. Corporations, defended as having the same rights as people, stand before the world with their pomp and power, insisting that they possess the only means to a profitable future. They exude an arrogance that becomes a dangerous spiritual arrogance as their promises are gathered and absorbed by a frightened populace. They have gained power around the world and shadow the promise that once was the United Nations. I am disturbed about a person not being a real person, but using a person's privileges to amass ludicrous wealth by destroying and poisoning the earth for generations, perhaps even thousands of years to come. I am disturbed about any corporation that refuses to cooperate with governments or world leaders under the pretense that economic growth is the only option, the only goal. I am disturbed that corporations keep you convinced that limited liability is somehow a sacred element of their functioning that must be protected at all costs, when more often than not, all it protects is a corporation's right to plunder, deceive, and desecrate. Must I emphasize the fact that truth is not often what is posted on a billboard or represented in moving images on the side of your Facebook page, amazing though they are. You know this to be true, but seem to be fooled by it at the same time. When we know what the truth is, how is it that we continue to protect corporations from its sweeping indictment? Corporations must do a great deal to mend their ways and heal the planet they have ravaged. There is another thing that disturbs me to no end about the dissonance between what you know to be true and the slow change in your behaviors as time unfolds itself beyond that coming of age. You have said again and again that you understand how dreadful colonization was and how deep its devastations. You teach such truths to your children in school. Yet even those once devastated by colonialism have converted to its powerful and ongoing presence. Privilege, once embraced, is hard to give up. The First Nations people of these lands, lands you still so often speak of as your own, await reconciliation. Paper promises have yet to be realized. Empty space exists between you and your First Nations peoples, space where relationship might flourish. You yearn to be loving people, but over and over again fail to live into the so many stories that invite you to weave your future with those of your Aboriginal sisters and brothers. How chilling that awareness should be to you. Yet perhaps its cold has not yet reached your marrow. Perhaps fear has yet to be conquered by knowledge. Indeed, the fear that rages in your land about the arrival of new immigrants, refugees from war, violence and death suppresses the larger truths that discomfort you. I had so hoped that my death had not been in vain. So I must urge you to get rid of everything that suppresses the full and unpleasant truth about your long relationship with First Nations and apply what you have learned to your embrace of refugee peoples from all lands. The broad universalism standing at the center of truth makes both the theory and practice of privilege morally unjustifiable. You know this. Now live it. Privilege too often substitutes an I-it relationship for the I-thou relationship we must pursue. No matter where our roots may interlace the face of this earth, If we neglect to dismantle long-standing systems of injustice and to create relationships of trust in order to create relationships of trust and forgiveness, we undermine our humanity. That is a simple truth. Relegating our first peoples or our most recent immigrants to the status of second-class citizens is no different than calling them things. Refusing to honor their status as persons, whole and beautiful and worthy, fractures humanity and demeans the dignity of us all. The quest for goodness, beauty, and truth is diametrically opposed to the underlying philosophy of privilege. And all the arguments about protecting what is ours or what we deserve, all the complicated logic in the world, erudite though its scholars might be, cannot make privilege and what is right lie down together. Decide as you have before, to commit to live into what is good. Only in living out that decision can you nurture beauty in your lives, in the lives of your First Nations peoples, and in the most humbled of the world's people who now stand on your doorstep. I praise your new government for committing to both attend to the recommendations of your nation's Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the urgent needs of refugees around the world. I'm happy to know that so many persons of goodwill have accepted these decisions as a great victory in our efforts to overcome fear. But I understand that there are some among you who have risen up in open defiance. I hear that they organize and lobby and work relentlessly to build fear again amongst you, stronger even than before. They have lost the true meaning of democracy and decency, so I would urge each of you to plead patiently with your sisters and brothers and tell them that this isn't the way. With understanding and goodwill, you are obligated to seek to change their attitudes. Let them know that in standing against the dismantling of privilege, they are not only standing against the noble precepts of your democracy, but also walking a road that forks toward the wrong side of history. Yes, my friends, there is still the need for prophets who will cry out to their nations, let judgment roll down as waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. May I say just a word to those of you who are struggling against these challenging and angry people. Always be sure that you struggle with methods and weapons that bring honor to humanity. Never succumb to the temptation of becoming bitter. As you press on for justice, be sure to move with dignity and discipline, using only the weapon of love. Let no one pull you so low as to hate him. Always avoid violence. If you succumb to the temptation of using violence in your struggle, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness, and your chief legacy to the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos. In your struggle for justice, let your opponents know that you are not attempting to defeat or humiliate them, or even pay them back for injustices they have heaped upon you, as a people or personally. Let them know that you are merely seeking justice for them as well as yourself. Let them know that the festering sore of privilege debilitates not only those who are disenfranchised by it, but all of us. With this attitude, you will be able to keep your struggle on high moral standards. Many persons will realize the urgency of seeking to eradicate the errors of privilege. There will be many who will devote their lives to the cause of equity and human dignity. There will be many persons of goodwill and of strong moral sensitivity who will dare to take a stand for justice. Honesty impels me to admit that such a stand will require willingness to suffer and sacrifice. So don't despair if you are condemned and persecuted for righteousness' sake. Whenever you take a stand for truth and justice, you are liable to scorn. Often you will be called an impractical idealist or a dangerous radical. Sometimes it might mean going to jail. If such is the case, you must honorably grace the jail with your presence. It might even mean physical death. But a physical death is the price that some must pay to free future generations from a permanent life of psychological death, then nothing could be more true. Don't worry about persecution, my friends. You are going to have that if you stand up for a great principle. I still believe that standing up for the truth is the greatest thing in the world. This is the end of life. This is the end of life The end of life is not to be happy. The end of life is not to achieve pleasure and avoid pain. The end of life is to have uplifted truth, and in doing so, laid the foundation for a better future, come what may. I must bring my writing to a close now. The courier is waiting to deliver this letter, and I must leave for another event. But just before leaving, I must say to you, as I said to others as well, that I still believe that love is the most durable power in the world. Over the centuries, many have sought to discover the highest good. This has been the chief quest of ethical philosophy. This was one of the big questions of Greek philosophy in which I reveled. The Epicureans and Stoics sought to answer it. Plato and Aristotle sought to answer it. What is the summum bonum of life? I think I have an answer, and I wish I had written it down sooner, so I might have been credited with the idea. I think I have discovered the highest good. It is love. This principle stands at the center of the cosmos. One who loves is a participant in the eternal nature of goodness, beauty, and truth. One who hates cannot share in the wonder of these things. So, my friends, allow me to paraphrase words penned by a man some 500 or so years after my death. You may recognize them, but I ask you to do more. I ask you to hear them. Let me speak to you today in the early years of your life or in the closing out of your time on this earth. Seekers after truth, you may master the intricacies of the English language. You may possess all of the eloquence of articulate speech. But even if you speak with the tongues of earthlings and of angels and have not love, you are become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. You may have the gift of prophecy and understanding all mysteries. You may be able to break into the storehouse of nature and bring out many insights that I, privileged as I was to live in one of the richest intellectual epochs of history, could have never dreamed were there. You may ascend to the heights of academic achievement so that you will have all knowledge. You may boast of your great institutions of learning and the boundless extent of your degrees, but all of this amounts to nothing, absolutely nothing, devoid of love. But even more, my friends, you may give your goods to feed the poor. You may give great gifts to charity. You may tower high in philanthropy, but if you have no love, you are still alone. You may even give your body to be burned and die the death of a martyr. Your spilt blood may be a symbol of honor for generations yet unborn, and thousands may praise you as history's supreme hero. But even so, if you have not love, your blood will have been spilt at the end of a life devoid of meaning. You must come to see that it's possible for someone to be self-centered in their self-denial and self-righteous in their self-sacrifice. They may be generous in order to feed their ego and pious in order to feed their pride. We have the tragic capacity to relegate a heightening virtue to a tragic vice. Without love, benevolence becomes egotism and martyrdom becomes spiritual pride. Without love, you are alone. So the greatest of all virtues is love. It is here that we find the true meaning of life. Or, because love cannot exist without us, it is the love we create that ultimately creates along with it the meaning of our lives. Love is a telescope through which we look out upon the long vista of eternity and interpret the things that have gone before. Was this moment one of love? Or was this of selfish pride and privilege? What about this one? Was this of love? Ultimately, we judge ourselves by our choices, and we triumph when our choice is love. Love is the most durable power in the world. It is, at its most basic, the heartbeat of the moral cosmos. Only through achieving love, creating, receiving, giving its tremendous power, can you expect to become part of the unfolding of beauty into eternity. I must say goodbye now. I hope this letter will find you strong and growing in love. It is probable that I will not get to see you even through the use of such time-spanning implements as this letter, but I am confident that our hearts pursue the same things. May you ever seek to keep one another from falling and lift each other from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of action, from the midnight of desperation to the daybreak of joy. May love abound. Sock. Each of you has somewhere within you that letter. That letter that comes from your hand. That letter that sees the relationships you're in, that sees what's happening in the world, that sees who you are, sometimes even too clearly to bear it yourself. I invite you to write that letter. You don't need to send it. You don't need to put a stamp on an envelope, but you need to write the letter. And then once you have it there on paper, once it's out there, everything you see that is the expectation of what will come, everything that was inside that you didn't think you had the courage to actually know, once it's out there, read it. Read it and then decide what it is you need to do. Thank you. We are never anywhere but on the edge of what is to come. We're never back in what happened before, and we're never at what's going to be. We're always only on the edge of what will come. But on that edge, how much we have to do, how much we can pour into it, how much beauty and love and goodness can be manifest in the moment that is the edge. Go from this place with one another, watch one another away, encourage, lift up, support, hallelujah, whoever needs it in your week to come. And may the edge on which you live glow with beauty because you have woven it there in the living of your lives. Go from this place in peace.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.